book and a terrific job at Law & Order Special Victims Unit. Being a father and being a writer and all of these things contribute to my comfort level of coming out.
I think I just saw two guys kiss on CBS, which is cool.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Among Belgium's newest newlyweds is its first queer couple, Take Me Out, to Hairspray highlight Broadway's Gayest Night, and gay Asian actor B.D. Wong finds fatherhood and more in Following Foo. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Dean Elzinger.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 7th, 2003. A lesbian couple this week contracted Belgium's first legal same-gender marriage. Belgium is only the second nation in the world to open legal marriage to gays and lesbians, following the Netherlands. Although Belgian marriages do not provide for same-gender couples to co-adopt each other's children or to adopt an unrelated child together. Newlyweds Marion Huybrechts and Christel Versvivelen have lived together for 16 years. Huybrechts told the De Morgen newspaper, "Marriage is the most profound promise of faith and love." While typically gay and lesbian couples compete to be the first to gain official recognition of their relationship, in Belgium it reportedly took some weeks to identify a couple who were willing to bear the publicity.
Not at all shy about proclaiming their relationship are two newly elected members of the Aberdeen City Council. As the Scottish Parliament wrestles with a proposal to create legal partnerships open to same-gender couples, Liberal Democrats Neil Fletcher and John Stewart announced their dream of holding a ceremony in Aberdeen's council chambers. They've never hidden their relationship of more than a decade, but with legal recognition the subject of heated public debate, they felt this was the time to make it perfectly clear. Stewart added, "First and foremost, we are councillors serving all the people in our wards. We are just two councillors who happen to be gay."
Jerusalem this week elected open gay Sar Netanel to its city council. The Meretz party member was running at large. Open lesbian Michal Eden, also of Meretz, was elected to the Tel Aviv city council 5 years ago. But Netanel is the first openly gay man to win an elected municipal office in Israel. While gays and lesbians celebrated his victory, he cautioned that the same elections had given religious conservatives both Jerusalem's mayoralty and a strong presence on the council, making immediate progress on gay and lesbian issues unlikely.
Another openly gay elected official, New Hampshire State Representative Corey Corbin, has switched his party affiliation from Republican to Democrat. His move was sparked by recent anti-gay comments by U.S. Senator Rick Santorum, which he said truly summed up for me the attitude of the Republican Party toward the millions of gay men and women who work, raise families, pay taxes, and contribute to our society. We are hated, we are marginalized, and are basically unwanted by a party that has forsaken the principles of Abraham Lincoln and become dominated by a right wing that falls far short of representing mainstream America.
Right-wing Republican U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft has effectively blocked the Gay and Lesbian Pride observance at the Department of Justice, an annual tradition since at least 1997, which last year featured the department's deputy leader as a speaker. The group DOJ Pride had planned a mid-June awards ceremony, but was advised this week that it could not be held at department headquarters. The notification cited a new, as yet unwritten, policy of Ashcroft's office that department sponsorship is now restricted to commemorations officially proclaimed by the president. Unlike Democratic President Bill Clinton, Republican George W. Bush has declined to proclaim Gay and Lesbian Pride Month. And while Ashcroft's policy may sound generic, it just so happens that Pride is the only commemoration it excludes. According to the Human Rights Campaign and Federal Globe, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender federal employees, this is the first time any federal agency has barred a Pride observance. The move has generated praise from the religious right and criticism from gays and lesbians and their allies, and it could end up in court.
Where the Department of Justice failed for years, despite one of the most massive manhunts in U.S. history, a rookie cop in a small North Carolina town succeeded, and long-sought serial bombing suspect Eric Rudolph was arrested last week. The targets included Atlanta, Georgia's Other Side Lounge, a now-defunct lesbian, gay, and trans bar where five people were injured in 1997. Rudolph is also charged with bombing two family planning clinics and a public celebration in connection with the 1996 Atlanta Olympics, for a total of two deaths and more than 100 people injured. He's believed to be associated with a hate group, although he denies it.
But in Britain, where a gay bar was also once a tragic target in a series of hate bombings, the government has rejected an amendment to its criminal justice bill that would have increased sentencing for anti-gay and other bias-motivated crimes. The National Gay and Lesbian Advocacy Group Stonewall and a coalition of groups representing likely victims of hate crimes had lobbied hard for the measure and will try to get it back on the table.
The Church of England and its 77 million member Global Anglican Communion are showing deep fissures on two gay issues. One is the appointment of Britain's newest bishop, Bishop of Reading Geoffrey John, a vocal advocate for gay and lesbian rights who is openly gay. He was formerly in a relationship with a man for more than 20 years, despite the Anglican requirement that clergy abstain from sex outside of legal heterosexual marriage. His supporters within the church hierarchy are confident that he is personally committed to a personal lifestyle of sexual abstinence. While his consecration as bishop is reportedly not in doubt, conservatives are lining up to demand he leave the clergy.
Those conservatives are led by the Anglican primates of Nigeria and the West Indies, who are also among seven primates to issue a call to action against Canadian Bishop Michael Ingham for authorizing rites to bless gay and lesbian couples in his Vancouver area New Westminster diocese. Other signatories are the primates of South America, Central Africa, Kenya, South India, and Papua New Guinea and Southeast Asia. But Ingham's most vocal opponent is Archbishop Peter Akinola of Nigeria, which is second only to Britain itself, with more than 17 million Anglicans. Three of the primates have already taken the strongest action they can, declaring themselves out of communion with Ingham. Some believe that the heads of more than half of the 38 Anglican provinces will follow suit.
Gay and lesbian couples in California celebrated the state assembly's passage this week of a bill to expand the state's registered partnerships to carry most of the state-level legal and financial status of marriage. The 41-29 vote was the minimum to send openly lesbian Democratic Assemblymember for Los Angeles Jackie Goldberg's bill on to the state Senate. In debate, opponents declared the bill would violate California's voter-passed constitutional amendment restricting legal marriage to one man and one woman.
A proposed similar amendment to the U.S. Constitution, the Federal Marriage Amendment, was reintroduced by three Republicans and three Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives last week. If enacted by a supermajority of both the House and the Senate, and by ratification of three-quarters of the states, it would add to the U.S. Constitution a statement that marriage in the United States shall consist only of the union of a man and a woman. Neither this Constitution nor the Constitution of any state, nor state or federal law, shall be constructed to require that marital status or the legal incidence thereof be conferred upon unmarried couples or groups. Last year's version died with no action taken.
There was good news for transsexuals in Lithuania and South Africa last week as each nation's government approved the introduction of bills to legally recognize gender change following sex reassignment surgery. Those bills will be considered in the national parliaments.
In Uzbekistan, three journalists active for media freedom have been arrested and one charged for homosexuality. New York-based Human Rights Watch has called attention to the situation, saying it has grounds for strong suspicions that the charges against Ruslan Sharipov are politically motivated persecution. Its spokesperson added that the authorities would charge him with committing homosexual acts, violating his fundamental rights to non-discrimination and privacy, makes it doubly egregious. According to the Associated Press, the sodomy law is rarely prosecuted in Uzbekistan.
Around the world, the Pride season is well underway. Among the highlights this week, the 13th annual Gay Pride Parade in San Juan, Puerto Rico, where some 4,000 people marched to demand repeal of the sodomy law and inclusion of same-gender couples in the law against domestic violence.
Pride in Aberdeen, one of only two Pride events in Scotland, where a record 2,500 visitors enjoyed an open-air festival.
South Africa's Pink Lowry Carnival in Knysna, where about 5,000 visitors and many locals packed Main Street six deep to watch a parade featuring 20 floats and numerous colorful dancers.
The first and hopefully annual Anti-Homophobia Day, officially proclaimed and partially funded by the government of the Canadian province of Quebec, began with the ceremonial raising of the rainbow flag in Montreal alongside the city and provincial flags, and launched a public education campaign by the group Gay Écoute that features pictures of gay and lesbian couples on flyers, posters, and billboards across the province.
And finally, openly lesbian French tennis pro Amélie Mauresmo was knocked out of the French Open this week in a quarterfinal match against Serena Williams. Hopes had been high for Mauresmo, who went in ranked number 5 in the world and the only one to have defeated both Williams sisters this year. But while Mauresmo is still looking for her first Grand Slam title, she's already been granted a form of immortality. Last week, she was unveiled as the only tennis player represented by a wax figure in Paris' Gravin Museum. Already a big celeb in France, she also gained a new level of exposure in May, appearing on the cover of Paris Match, topless.
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 7th, 2003, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
Cause I like the way I am, and you just can't stop a knife and fork when I see a Christmas ham. So if you don't like the way I look, well, I just don't give a damn. Cause the world keeps spinning round and round, and my heart's keeping time to the speed of sound. I was lost till I heard the drum, and I found my way. You can't stop.
It may have been Broadway's gayest night ever when the 57th Annual Tony Awards were handed out at Radio City Music Hall in New York City on June 8th. Take Me Out, about a star baseball player doing just that, won Best Play and a trophy for openly gay featured actor Dennis O'Hare.
My beautiful boyfriend Hugo Redwood is here. He supports me. I want to just thank him.
Hairspray, based on openly gay John Waters' Divine starring film set in early 1960s Baltimore, took home 8 Tonys, including Best Musical and Best Actor Musical for Harvey Fierstein as hefty matriarch Edna Turnblad.
The theater community is just a huge loving family, and I am blessed every day of my life to just be part of you people. I adore each and every one of you. I want to have your children, and I promise to raise them well. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
But the most unabashedly gay moments came early in the evening, prompting comments by several other winners throughout the nationally televised broadcast.
I have never, ever in my life been more proud to be a member of this community. Men kissing each other on stage, drag queens, children. It's a perfect world. As it should be.
I think I just saw two guys kiss on CBS, which is cool.
And the winners were Hairspray original musical score composers Scott Whitman and Mark Shaman, longtime domestic as well as musical partners.
My mother took me to Radio City every Saturday morning when I was a kid, and she used to say to me, one day you'll be up there. I always thought she meant a rockette. I never knew it was going to be this. There's so many people to thank, and God willing, you'll meet them all tonight. But I have to say there's the one special person who I share my life with, my laughter, and all of my heart for the amazing 25 years. Mark Shaman.
Margot Lyon, thank you for saving our lives. Our relationship was doing fine without you, but it's never been better. And I love this man. We're not allowed to get married in this world. I don't know why, but I would like to declare in front of millions of people, I love you, and I'd like to live with you the rest of my life.
Every actor worth his salt strives to be honest and true in his portrayals on the stage or screen. Hello, this is Ian McKellen, and that's exactly what this program does as well. Join Greg and Lucia each week for This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine right here on this station.
He's played M. Butterfly on the New York stage and the idealistic prison chaplain, Father Ray Mukata, on the HBO cable drama Oz, and he's currently featured as forensic psychiatrist George Wang on NBC TV's Law & Order Special Victims Unit. But in his real-life roles as gay partner, father, and now author, B.D. Wong charmingly portrays himself. He discusses growing up, coming out, and the genesis of his newly released book, Following Fu, The Electronic Adventures of the Chestnut Man, a memoir, with This Way Out's Josie Kitogio.
This is really a remarkable story. I didn't know that you were a writer before you were an actor.
I was never a professional writer before I was an actor, but I always wrote. I wrote from when I was in high school. In fact, that was probably one of the first kind of creative things that I did that people responded to. I have found my way back to it after a long journey of becoming an actor and doing lots of different things. And this is terrific for me because it kind of helps me to kind of define myself. You know, being a writer is a huge part of myself that has been laying dormant for so long. And so it's just wonderful for me.
I'm glad that it's rejuvenated. And I hope there will be many more books because you are a rather extraordinary writer.
I appreciate your saying so, Josie. I hope so, too.
Well, this book is about you and your lover having children. But before we go there, for our audience, I want you to talk about what it meant to grow up gay and Asian American and to come out of the closet as an actor, which most people were terrified to do.
Well, I mean, how much time do we have? You know, growing up, first of all, I did grow up in San Francisco, and that is as everybody knows, it's like Oz, you know, it's a special, special place. And being gay there is not as big an issue as it is in other places. However, for me, growing up in an Asian American family, Chinese American family, there were traditional values that I think it was never said out loud, but it just didn't seem like the kind of thing that a good Chinese son, you know, declares. I had a great deal of difficulty kind of negotiating the definition of who I was when I was a young man. And it really has taken me all until very recently to feel like I have fully defined myself. And coming out has been a huge part of that. And coming out is directly related to the book and being a father and all of the things that have happened to me in the last 3 years and writing and all of these kind of crazy planes colliding at the same time. So growing up in San Francisco was probably a lot like growing up for any gay teen or gay child anywhere in the country. There was the same kind of inner turmoil, the inner kind of discovery, inner confusion and questions. And it all played itself out, as it almost always does, into my young adulthood and into my adulthood. You know, it's a journey that you can't say you would wish you would change because it is who you are and how you became who you are. And so I don't want to change that. But it was full of rather bumpy kind of roads.
Well, the career path you chose made it even more difficult because it's difficult enough being an Asian American actor, let alone being a gay Asian American actor.
Sure. I chose, acting chose me in some ways. I discovered acting when I was in high school and I was immediately set on fire by it. I knew immediately that it was really the first thing that I ever experienced that I loved, that I felt loved me back, if you will. I had done lots of other creative things. I played the violin and I sang and all of these things. And here was one thing that kind of just seemed so right. And I just felt so free. And I felt, again, it's a recurring theme these days, I felt like I was myself. And so I started pursuing it and kind of becoming more interested in it and taking it on kind of as a hobby. And I let my schoolwork go and all of those traditional things. And then I discovered it when I decided I thought I might really like to do it for a career. What a kind of contradictory thing it was for me to be Asian American and want to do this at the same time. My parents were very traditional about wanting me to go into a very traditional kind of doctor, lawyer kind of job.
Like your brothers.
Like my brothers. And yet at the same time, they saw my enthusiasm. My enthusiasm really, Josie, could not have been denied by anybody who was ever in the room with me when I was doing this, you know, seeing me in a play or in a musical or something. And yet there was a real frustrating point in time where I had a realization that, wow, I'm not going to get all the parts like I got in high school. You know, what am I going to do about that? I wanted it so badly, I went into it anyway. And I went into it anyway because I hoped that I could help to change it. I don't know. I was very naive, or that I could that times would change, or that opportunities would come, and that I would just try to make the most of them. And in some ways that's happened. In some ways it's still very frustrating, and it's still in some ways the it remains to be seen how Asian Americans will find their way into, you know, mainstream media in a big way.
And about coming out, so many actors are terrified. You know, Richard Chamberlain just came out at the age of almost 70, His partner was always second and had to stay closeted for his sake.
Can you imagine?
Because he, you know, he put his career first.
Yes.
How did you have the courage to come out and still pursue acting when everybody tells you, oh, you'll never get another job?
Right. Well, it remains to be seen what the flack is going to be, really. You know, I have a terrific job at Law & Order Special Victims Unit.
I love that show. It's our favorite show.
Oh, thanks.
Now that Buffy the Vampire Slayer is gone.
Oh, yes. Oh, so we're second only to the great Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Well, that's comforting. You know, the book and being a father and all of these crazy things, being a writer and all of these things contribute to my comfort level of coming out. I know who I am a lot more than I did, you know, 3 years ago before my boys were born. And that this really helps me to be very comfortable with whatever path God is going to take me on from this point on. And I really believe, and this is a theme in my book, that that path needs to not be controlled by us, by our— one can't try to control their own path. It just doesn't work. It's not organic, and it's not conducive to enjoying life or being at one with the joy of being a human being. That's— control is not part of it. I didn't realize that until these things happened to me. So coming out has been rather liberating and rather hopeful for me. I think it's just only been positive. You know, I hasten to add that the people at NBC and Universal that Law & Order was on have been so wonderful to me about everything, about the book and everything that the book entails. And parenthetically, that's coming out. There has never been anyone who has said, oh, you mustn't do this. Please don't tell anyone you're on the show, or please don't. None of those kind of old-fashioned ideas, those old Hollywood ideas that you hear about from the MGM days, those kinds of things. So something's shifted in that way, and something wonderful is happening to allow me to do this and feel unfettered at the same time. So I'm grateful for that.
I love that as a man, this experience taught you that control is an illusion, because my belief is our need for control is out of control.
Yes. And,
and that all of us need to learn to surrender when we must.
All of us. Do you think that that's a male trait, control?
I think in some ways, men are more fixed on— they feel that they must do something.
Yes.
You know, and you had to learn you couldn't do something. You had to wait.
Yes. Except what the acceptance and the not doing was the doing.
Right. Exactly.
Yes.
I'm talking with B.D. Wong about his book, Following Fu. This was an amazing adventure. You and your partner, who's Jewish, Jackson.
Jewish American,
both have big extended families and know tons of people. He's also in the entertainment industry. And when you decided you wanted children, his sister contributed an egg. You contributed the sperm. This wonderful surrogate mom here in California carried the babies and twins.
Yes.
And then 3 months early, she went into labor.
Yes. She went into the labor 3 months early. They did stop it. We were so on tender hooks. We were in New York. Richie and I were in New York. A week later, I just happened to be in L.A. shooting The Salton Sea, and they wouldn't let me fly home for Memorial Day weekend. So I went up to visit Shauna, and I said, well, I'll spend the Memorial weekend visiting Shauna. I visited her periodically in the 6 months.
You went to some of her doctor appointments with her. I thought that was so sweet.
Oh,
bi-coastal.
Who wouldn't want to miss a doctor's appointment with the woman carrying your kids? And so she went into labor again while I was visiting her. And that was the first of what I would call a huge series of non-coincidences that pointed to, I don't know what, but, you know, kind of showing me what real life is all about. And the boys were born in Modesto at the end of May instead of the middle of August. And that started 3 months of trials and tribulations in the intensive care nursery, first in Modesto and eventually flying to San Francisco, where we we're introduced to amazing medical personnel at the University of California, San Francisco, intensive care nursery. And during that time, I started writing these crazy emails to our loved ones in New York because we were so stressed out and we were trying to tell them what was going on. And I was trying to keep everyone abreast of what was going on. And really having a premature infant in ICU is maddening and insane and full of twists and turns. And so I started writing about some of these crazy things and trying to show my stress and deal with my stress by trying to find humor in the situation. And people wrote back to us the most remarkable, inspiring, moving, and supportive things. So I just kept writing. And when I first wrote the first email to say, this very sad thing has happened. We've had our sons 3 months early, and only one of them has made it. When I wrote that, I didn't intend to continue to write, and they wrote back amazing things. They said, please tell us what was going to happen. A week later, we were having surgery. Jackson was having surgery on his tiny little intestines, and I wrote back to say, please pray for us, and they wrote back again to say, we're praying for you, and God bless you, and I'm thinking of you, all in whatever different spiritual way they had. Many, many people have different ways of expressing it, and that's what's so wonderful and diverse and beautiful about reading these emails that came back. And the response emails are in the book too. At the end of the 3 months, after going back and forth and writing and crying and laughing and trying to make sense of it all, there is this incredible documentation that happened quite organically of this event in my family's life. And someone found out about it, passed it on the word to a literary agent. The literary agent sent out a proposal that I had compiled of the emails to HarperCollins and other publishers. HarperCollins bought the book, and all of a sudden there's this object that tells the entire story and tells it in a way which is rather unconventional and rather fun in some ways, if you will. For such a desperate situation, there's a fair amount of levity in it and a fair amount of irony and a fair amount of, if you can imagine a normal guy like me just kind of going through this experience that I never thought I would have and kind of going, can you believe this is happening to me? The incredulity of that was part of what I found kind of funny in some way. I don't know why. And so people have always been very encouraging about it. The people that have read the book now have been just terrific about it. It's a life-changing experience. Being a father is life-changing enough, but writing about your son after this experience, both of your sons after this experience, and finding your voice as a writer at the same time and coming out. I mean, can you imagine all of the different things that are just really just crashing together in a brilliant way? For me at this point in time, and I'm grateful to God for that.
The title of actor, father, author B.D. Wong's book is Following Fu, The Electronic Adventures of the Chestnut Man, a memoir published by HarperCollins. His conversation with our Josie Cotoggio continues next time on This Way Out. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Dean Elzinga, Fensberry, Rex Wachner, and Josie Cotoggio contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. We can't survive without you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air and get some queer audio history and timeless music in the bargain, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WRUV Burlington, Vermont, CJSR Edmonton, Alberta, KRCL Salt Lake City, Utah, and more than 135 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Please do stay tuned.